Acorns are dropping off my Chinese house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Welcome to Yarns at Yin Hu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 132, Stash Dashed, Sunday, August 21st, 2016. I'm your host, Sarah. You can find me on social media as Sarah Pomegranate. The Yarns at Yin Hu podcast has a Facebook page, and it's available on iTunes. Today's episode features the following segments: the back porch, the front porch, ever-expanding skill set, and so forth. Thanks so much to everyone who has sent comments or made comments on the Ravelry threads for recent episodes. The past two episodes were a bit of a departure from my usual format, and I just chronicled some of my summer travels and my vacation in Provincetown, Massachusetts. So those episodes are great for sitting back with a nice beverage and your knitting and just listening along. And today we return to my usual format with more information about my projects and things I'm planning, things I'm learning. This past week, on August 16th, it was the podiversary of the Yarns at Yin Hu podcast. It has been 3 years since I began podcasting with Yarns at Yin Hu. If you are a new listener, you may be wondering about the title of the podcast, Yarns at Yin Hu. Yin Hu refers to my home, Yin Hu Chaoyuan, Silver Lake Tea House. The place where I live was originally built as a tea house in the early 1920s. It was a tea room with a gift shop upstairs, and no one lived in it. Over the years, there were squatters. The ownership of the house changed hands many times. And Samuel, my partner Samuel, and I are the first people to own the place and to live in it. And we've done a series of renovations and restorations. We still have a long way to go, but we're trying to improve the curb appeal, the functionality. It's slow going, but it is gratifying when it happens. In the early days, I recorded episodes of the podcast in my home, but Yin Hu sits very close to the road, and I became a little bit frustrated with the road sounds that would make their way onto the podcast. So for the past year or so, maybe more, I have been using a space just a few miles from my home. It's a rehearsal space for Samuel's band, Bovine Social Club, and it's located in historic Castle Inn, which used to be a very posh inn for New Yorkers and others coming in on the train. And now it's being repurposed as a reception hall and small offices and spaces for many different businesses. The third floor is pretty much dedicated to people in the music business, and early Sunday morning is a time when I can be quite certain not too many musicians are interested in being up and noisy, so I have a nice quiet space to record. The crafting that I talk about on the podcast occurs almost exclusively at Yin Hu. In warm weather in particular, I am most likely to be found on the back porch with a cold drink and my knitting or my spinning and just enjoying the breeze and the beautiful views of the canopy. And also there's a steep ravine with a creek and a waterfall down below. So it is a wonderful, very inspiring place to create. And if you follow me on Instagram, you can also see some of the features of the home. May give you the impression of an arts and crafts style home because it was built during that time, but also with an eye toward Chinese influence that was popular in the early 1920s. The back porch. This summer, I've been competing in Stash Dash, which ends today. I think it ends today. At least I am done competing as of today. And my goal for Stash Dash was to knit up and spin up a total of at least 5K of yarn and fiber. This is 5,468 yards for me, since I work primarily in yards and then convert things over to meters only when absolutely necessary. This was a challenge for me this summer because, unlike some folks who are very strategic about their Stash Dash planning and complete projects during the summer that they've been knitting all year long, I usually just start with whatever happens to be on my needles, and I tend not to let projects languish or accumulate so that I can finish them in the summer. So pretty much everything I worked on, I started new since Memorial Day weekend. And I thought when I was working on my project with the ball of Riften yarn, which was 600 yards, that, you know, that would be an excellent addition to my Stash Dash goals, but I ended up frogging that project. And I may have been a bit rash because I finished it, I bound off, I put it on without blocking it, without even steaming it. I put it on and it just looked misshapen and awful to me. And I just felt like I had messed up the whole thing and maybe chosen the incorrect project for the yarn, or some of the adjustments I made to the pattern were unwise. And I just ripped the whole thing out right before I left for vacation. So that was maybe not such a good idea. When I talked to Mary Beth about it, she said, "Well, did you try blocking it?" I said, "No, I just ripped it out." So I had 600 yards to make up for. And what I ended up doing was completing a pattern design that I had in the works and then knitting another version of that to check my pattern and also so that it could be a booth sample for the yarn dyer. So that gave me nearly 1,000 more yards to my goal. And then I knew I had done some other knitting and spinning, but I hadn't really quantified it. So I searched for those projects and added some of the preemie hats that I work on. I tend to always have a preemie hat with me in my bag or my purse, and I just put them in the bin at school for charity, and then the student knitters I have add to that, and we send that off each year. So I had some of those, and then I had some of the meditative spindling that I've been doing. Usually I just work with small bits of roll lags and batlings, and I'm not sure what I'm going to do with all this yarn, if I would put it into a big project or not. I like to knit little birds of happiness periodically, and those amounts are perfect for a project like that. But I just counted up all of that yardage, and those projects combined with things that I had been working on and completing all summer gave me a total of 5,570 yards. So I would consider that my goal has been met. Although one thing that happened over the course of this late spring and summer is that I think I accumulated a little bit more in the way of stash than I actually knit up and spun up during Stash Dash. So I'll have to be mindful of that as the year progresses. In addition to the new design that I was working on, I also completed this past week the Selkie Hat and Mitt Set. This is a pattern by Bristol Ivy, which appeared in Taproot issue 17. It's the Myth issue, and it's a beautiful cabled hat and mitts set. I began this earlier in the summer, and it's not really a travel project because the cabling takes quite a bit of brain power and concentration. So I worked on this off and on, and I'm just love the yarn choice, and it's going to make such a beautiful gift. A few things about this pattern. First of all, I used a tubular cast-on for the cast-on for both the hat and the mitts. For this, I use Isolde Teague's method for a tubular cast-on, and then I converted it to a 2x2 rib as specified in the pattern. Based on the challenge that Twin Set Ellen issued recently to commit important skills to memory rather than looking them up all the time, I have worked very hard on committing the tubular cast-on and bind-off to memory. And I think Isolde Teague's video is excellent. She gives directions for 1x1 rib and converting that to a 2x2 rib. I used US size 5 needles for the hat and 4 for the mitts. This is a worsted weight yarn pattern, and the needle called for is a US size 6. However, I tend to be a loose knitter, so I thought that size 5 for the hat would be appropriate. And then I used size 4 DPNs for the mitts because I am knitting these for quite a petite gift recipient. And I thought that the small hands combined with my loose gauge would make the size 4 perfect for the project. I can put the mitts on. I have extremely large hands, and they're a little bit tight on me, so I think they're going to be perfect for my gift recipient. And I used Juniper Moon Farm Moonshine. It's a wool alpaca silk blend, and I used June Bug, which is a beautiful turquoise color. This yarn, I don't think, is a hard-wearing yarn. This is more of a luxurious, silky, soft choice, not something that's meant for outside use or getting firewood or something like that. These are meant to be sort of used for nice kind of mitts and hat. But I think the pattern really lends itself to some rugged wools and could be much more durable for outside use or for around the farm use. And I enjoyed the way this pattern came out so much that even though it's a little bit challenging with all the cables, I would like to make it again. And I have some yarn in mind for that. I was uncertain about the tubular bind-off method for 2x2 rib because I've done this bind-off before. I really like Very Pink Knits tutorials, and whenever there's something that I need to do in knitting, I usually check with her first because her tutorials are so clear, and she often gives other resources and information included with the videos as well. But her tutorial is for binding off, tubular bind off of a 1x1 rib, and these mitts close with a 2x2 rib. So I searched around online and figured out that one way I could resolve this issue would be to convert the 2x2 rib to 1x1 using kind of a reversal of the tubular cast-on method that Isolde Teague uses. So this just requires going around the last round before you bind off, and you just reverse the order of a few stitches so that you now have a 1x1 rib on your needle, and then you just use that tubular bind-off method. It's very similar to the Kitchener stitch with just a little bit of a difference since you're binding off from one needle instead of from two. But I really enjoyed the process of committing this to memory rather than just looking it up and completing the steps. And I want to thank Twinset Ellen for issuing that challenge, because I think it's making a little bit of a difference in my confidence as a knitter. Once again, that pattern is the Selkie Hat and Mitts set by Bristol Ivy, and it appeared in Taproot issue 17, which is the myth issue. The Front Porch. Since completing projects for Stash Dash, I don't have a lot on my needles these days, but I do have a pair of socks that I've been working on. These were beach knitting when I was out on Cape Cod. It's lovely gift yarn from the Knitting Goddess. Mary Beth gave me this beautiful skein in some of my very favorite hues. And it's an interesting blend of fibers. I'm not completely sure of the fiber content since the ball band doesn't list them completely, but I am certain that these are going to be just very cozy winter socks for me. And I am improvising the pattern as I go along, using some of the things that I've learned about sock knitting over the past several years. It's also a socks experiment because I'm using two different brands of needles. Both are US size 0, and I'm knitting these socks in tandem. It's rather a plain sock with a tubular cast on, of course. I just think that the tubular cast on and bind off give such a clean, finished, polished look. And it has so much stretch to it that it doesn't really make sense to me to use any other kind of a cast-on or bind-off for a sock or a glove or a mitt. So that's the way I'm rolling from now forward. So I use the tubular cast-on and then a 2x2 rib for the cuff, and then the leg of the sock is just knitting in the round. I attempted using a 9-inch circular. That was my initial idea for the sock experiment, was to be to knit one sock on double-pointed needles and another on the 9-inch circular. But it's just not comfortable for me to knit on that circular. I think my hands are too large and the manipulations seem to be too small. And so my knitting just became so loose, I wasn't happy with the result. So I've switched to using DPNs. And DPNs are my preferred method for sock knitting at this time. For this sock experiment, I'm knitting two socks in tandem. They have a tubular cast on, a 2x2 rib for the cuff, a plain leg, and then I used the heel flap, heel turn, and gusset directions from the Agatha Socks by Claire of New Hampshire Knits. I was very impressed with some of the tips she gave in her directions, and as I knit the Agatha Socks earlier this summer, I thought that I would like to go back and use these same directions for the heel on a plain sock that I would be knitting later. These are directions that I would like to commit to memory. Right now, I'm referring to Claire's pattern, and that has worked well, especially since I'm knitting the socks in tandem, so I'm doing exactly the same thing on each sock. But I really like the method that she describes. I have finished the heel flap, heel turn, and gusset on each of the socks, and now I'm knitting the foot of the sock. And one additional feature that I'm adding to these is something I've heard, I'm not sure which podcaster I heard talk about this, but someone was mentioning the use of ribbing, a 1x1 rib on the bottom of the foot for maybe an inch and a half, 2 inches following the completion of the gusset. I've noticed that the athletic socks I like the most have this kind of a structure to them. They often have something stretchy or tight, maybe even more elastic or a different kind of knitting around the arch of the foot. And it helps keep the sock on, but I also feel like it helps give your foot a little more energy. So I'm using that technique of a 1x1 rib across the bottom of the foot only. And I'll go for maybe 2 inches or so. I suppose this will be the point at which I start to try the sock on. And then I'll need to decide if I'm going to add a few stitches to accommodate the width of my foot before I start the end of the foot. And then I plan to just taper off and close the toe with a very traditional Kitchener stitch. I will talk a little bit more about the sock experiment of using 2 different brands of size 0 needles on this sock in a future episode. I'll be recording that episode as number 133 or number 134. I'm not exactly certain at this time, but I would like to record an episode devoted to knitting needles, brands of needles, types of materials, and also needle storage. And I would like to record that before the end of the summer. In order to do that, I have invited Yarns at Yanhu listeners to participate in a poll and also to share information, tips, photographs, also questions that you may want answered either by me or maybe some more experienced knitters in the group. And there is a prize associated with participation on that thread. So be sure to check that out on the Yarns at Yanhu group on Ravelry. I won't be closing that thread until just before I record the episode. So there's at least another week to participate, perhaps more, and you can chime in as many times as you want. That increases the likelihood that you will win the prize. And the prize is a set of needles of your choice from the Woolly Thistle. Claire is currently carrying Hiya needles, the Woolly Thistle, but I think she's going to be expanding her offerings in the very near future. So the winner of this prize will get to select the needles that they want, and I will purchase them. And I want to thank Claire for all of her support of the podcast. Ever-expanding skill set. After a very hot spell when I really didn't feel like cooking anything for a few weeks, the weather has cooled a bit and I have revived my interest in using farm fresh produce and doing some cooking. This week in particular, I plan to focus on using tomatoes because I bought some beautiful sun gold cherry tomatoes. They're so sugary sweet. I can't wait to cook with them, and I've been thinking about some different recipes I could use, including one that was some kind of polenta cake. I think it was made in a cast iron skillet, and then it has burst cherry tomatoes as part of the dish. So I think I'll be trying that one. I have been continuing my reading of Around the World in 6 Glasses, and I've completed the coffee chapter, and I'm now reading the tea chapter. So I've been making some tea and coffee drinks this summer in honor of that reading, and I've been looking for some new ideas for using those things in my kitchen. For a number of years now, I've been making kombucha, and I continue to let my SCOBY for the kombucha go rather dormant over the colder months, and then reviving it and continuing to make kombucha during the summer months. I really like this refreshing drink, and I like to let my kombucha mature so that it's very sour and effervescent when I drink it. I feel like that makes it more thirst quenching. And some people really don't like that, so I'm pretty much the only one who drinks the kombucha that I make at my house. I've been experimenting with putting in some flavored tea bags in addition to the black tea, and I've really liked the addition of ginger tea in that mix. So that's been good, and then I was looking for a way to experiment with coffee. A few episodes back, I mentioned horchata, and I found out about this because I subscribe to the Bon Appetit on Instagram, and they had a video for a horchata latte, which intrigued me. The method for making this horchata, which refers to using a rice or a grain in a drink, it creates a creamy, delicious, cold coffee drink without the addition of any dairy product. And I believe it uses a relatively low amount of caffeine while still tasting like delicious coffee. So what you can do is you could follow Bon Appetit on Instagram and you could see this video for yourself. I believe it's also online and I will link it. Or I will outline the basic steps here. You take a cup of jasmati or basmati rice and a quarter cup of delicious coffee beans, and you whiz these up in your blender, just dry. You add some smashed cardamom seeds, some cinnamon stick, some dates. I used figs instead of dates. And the recipe also calls for some cocoa nibs. I just threw in a couple of dark chocolate chips that I had in my pantry. And then you add water, 4 cups of water. I have added more than 4 cups of water. In fact, one of the things I do is I make up this dry mixture and then I reserve half. I make half of it into a horchata, and then I have another half that I can use a little bit later in the week. So I added about 3.5 cups of water to half of this dry mixture. Shake it up, or you could leave it in your blender and leave it refrigerated overnight. The next morning, or whenever you want your horchata, you put it back on the blender, whiz it up again, and then you strain this mixture. This to me has been the most challenging part of the horchata latte because initially I was getting a little bit of a gritty taste, like some of that very fine rice and coffee ground was coming through the strainers that I was using. And so I've taken to using a series of 3 different strainers. One just to get most of the solids out of the drink, then kind of a medium grade one, and then a very, very fine strainer for the very last step. And that strainer is so fine that I have to constantly stir the mixture in order to get the liquids to come through. I sweeten this mixture with a little bit of maple syrup or honey, and serve it extremely, extremely cold over ice or over coffee ice cubes. And it has been absolutely delicious and refreshing. And I feel like it's easier on the stomach because number one, it doesn't have dairy. And number two, the coffee has never been heated. So it doesn't have that acidic quality that coffee can sometimes have. It's a variation, I suppose, on a cold brewing method, but one that I really enjoy. So horchata and kombucha. Kombucha, by the way, if you've never made it, there is an excellent article about making kombucha and also kefir in issue 17 of Taproot magazine. And I feel that the author, in particular, when writing about kombucha, is very practical about it. A lot of things I've read about kombucha involve like how you have to be so careful and treating it like it's this precious thing. I'm not very gentle with my SCOBY or, you know, overly worried about my kombucha mixture, and it's fine. So I like the advice that's given in this article that's a little more practical and down to earth and involves a lot less anxiety and careful steps. So it's worth checking out if you're interested in some different takes on your tea and coffee consumption this summer. And so forth. In this segment, I talk about specific sewing projects as well as the general progress that I'm making toward my plan for a mostly handmade wardrobe. This is a 5-year plan. I'm in year 2. And even though I never realize all of the things that I want to achieve with my handmade wardrobe, I feel like I've made some important realizations this summer. One is that I tend to be most productive if I use a good chunk of time cutting out and planning projects, and then smaller amounts of time working on sewing those projects. So one day early on in the summer, I think I cut out about 5 different things. I just worked on prepping the fabric, getting the patterns exactly the way I wanted them, cutting everything out and transferring all of the markings to my fabric. And then I folded those up and I kept them near my desk so that I could decide which project I wanted to work on and just begin sewing it. And that seemed to work quite well, and I was pleased that I hadn't changed my mind about wanting that garment, even though I had cut into the fabric so far in advance. I've also realized that while a new pattern may attract my interest when I see someone else's, you know, beautiful creation, I really need to think carefully about the patterns that I purchase, because it can easily become a really big expense. And if I'm only going to use the pattern one time, it's not a very good investment. So I try to envision whether or not this design or variations on the design will be interesting enough to make 3 different versions of that pattern. And if my answer is yes, I think it's a worthwhile investment. If the answer is no, then I need to think about, okay, is this for a super special occasion that, you know, I'm going to spend a lot of money maybe on the fabric anyway, and it really has to be this design, then maybe that purchase is still a good idea. But if it's something that I'm not feeling sure about, or I'm not certain it's going to suit my body type or my lifestyle, then it's best to pass on that pattern, even if the way somebody else looks in it is like super cute or they use the most adorable fabric for it. It's better just to pass and to go with something that's going to be a little more practical for me. Because my initial idea with the handmade wardrobe is to be practical and to make the kind of clothes that I want to wear every day, and to make the kind of clothes that make me satisfied with having less because I enjoy wearing them and I want to wear them more often. It would be unrealistic for me to think that I could ever make the same amount of clothes as I could purchase commercially. So eventually, if I continue down this road, my wardrobe will inevitably shrink, and I need to feel still happy and satisfied with that. So far, the best pattern purchase I have made has been the staple dress. It's a pattern by April Rhodes. It's very simple with a front and a back. It has an option for pockets and it has facings, a facing for the neckline. And over time, I've made this pattern. I think I'm on my fifth or sixth version of this pattern now. It has two different hemlines. One is straight, and I have not made that hemline yet. I have only made the drop hem version of this pattern. And over time, I've been able to incorporate some of the techniques that I've learned with pattern drafting and with sewing to make this more and more customized to my figure. So I've become more and more happy with the results of this dress. First of all, I've learned how to lengthen it successfully. I find a lot of these dress and tunic patterns are extremely short on someone who's a little bit taller, and I'm 5'8", I'm not extremely tall, but it seems inappropriately short sometimes, the length of the dress as it's specified in the pattern. I always need to either find or create a lengthening line and add some length to the pattern. And I really do appreciate a pattern with a lengthening line. So the pattern designer is telling you where it's appropriate to add length. And then a French curve or a hip curve tool is really essential for smoothing out that difference when you make an adjustment like that. And I've found a lot of success with that. So that's one change that I've made to the staple dress pattern. Another is that I've added bust darts to this pattern. And finally, I'm happy with my bust darts that point to the fullest part of my breasts. And I've lengthened the front piece of the pattern appropriately so that when I take up fabric for the bust dart, it's still long enough to meet the back, the pattern back, when I sew the side seams together. I have added pockets and not added pockets to this pattern depending on the amount of time I care to take making that adjustment. I think it's always a good idea to use a very thin, silky fabric for the pockets, not necessarily the fabric that you're using to make the dress. And in my most recent version of this pattern, I used a black linen blend for the dress, which I think is going to be incredibly versatile. And I used some of that beautiful Liberty fabric for the pockets. Another thing that I've done to adjust this pattern is to use store-bought bias tape for the neckline and the armholes. I think in the original pattern, you make your own bias tape for the neckline, and then you just fold in the fabric for the armholes. And I think that process of making your own bias tape and cutting that on the bias, number one, it takes up additional fabric. So you can get away with using less fabric if you omit that step. And number two, it's just quick and easy to use store-bought bias tape. And it cuts down on some of the bulk around the sleeve. So even though there aren't sleeves per se on the staple dress, it's cut so that it creates a kind of a cap sleeve. So that makes it quick and easy. It cuts down on the bulk. And then because this dress was very plain black, I used a hot pink bias tape, which I think just adds the right amount of interest. And at certain angles, you can just see the slightest hint of that hot pink bias tape. The final adjustment that I've made to the staple dress is to alter the way that you're advised to use elastic thread around the waist. So the pattern instructs you to put the dress on, find the point at which your natural waist occurs, or to put a belt around the skirt and see where that belt fits comfortably, and then mark that spot so you can add 1, 2, 3, 4 lines of elastic around the entire waistband of the dress. I wanted a silhouette that was a little more elegant. And so what I did was to cut in the sides of the dress front just a little bit so that there was less fabric at the smallest part of my waist. The back I didn't alter. I kept it the same. But I cut into the front a little bit, and my French curve was a really great tool for that. I used an overlock stitch on the sides of the fabric. I don't have a serger, so that's my answer to a nice finish on the inside. And then instead of running elastic thread all the way around the waistband, I just ran 3 lines of elastic thread a half inch apart in the back third or so of the waistline. So on the back of the dress, there are about 8 to 9 inches of elastic shirring that just cinch the back of the dress up. This will be totally covered if I wear a belt over the dress, but it's equally flattering if I just wear the dress with the plain front and then the shirring in the back. I think it creates a nice silhouette when you look at the front, and it suits that drop hem also in the back of the dress. So overall, I feel like I have finally made the dress that I've wanted to make since I got my sewing machine and I started working on a handmade wardrobe. It's not that I've had this dress in mind and wasn't making it. It's just that when I completed this dress, I thought to myself, okay, this is the dress that I've been trying to make, or this is the dress that I should have been making all of this time. And then immediately I made another one, and I used a really fun print. I think I mentioned that when Mary Beth and I went to Loom Exquisite Textiles and the amazing sale that they were having, there were some fabrics for as little as $2 a yard. It was quilting cotton. It's not apparel fabric. But this washed up really nice. It kind of has a nice, soft feel to it, even though it's a very inexpensive kind of quilting cotton. It's a bright red background with a really fun vintage telephone print on it. And I just made another version of that same staple dress immediately following the black dress. It made me wish that I had purchased more of this $2 a yard fabric at the sale, but I think it's something that I can keep on hand for maybe some future dresses. I think it's nice to have a really fun print, but in a very sophisticated design, and that still keeps it kind of work appropriate and a lot of fun. Since completing those two dresses, I've also cut out a front and back for the new Willow Tank pattern that I purchased, and I'm going to try this with some denim fabric, like a denim cambray for the back. This is the same fabric I used recently on the Endless Summer Tunic. And the front of this tank will be some beautiful Luna Moth printed fabric that I purchased at the Loom showroom. I also have decided to extend my skill set by making some dop kits as Christmas gifts this year. So this is a project that will extend into the fall and early winter probably, but I would like to use some denim and also the cotton laminate fabric that I purchased to make some toiletries bags with a zipper closure. And since this will be quite a lot of fabric going through the sewing machine, I have purchased a walking foot for my sewing machine. So I'll be experimenting with that, with zipper installation, and with using some new kinds of fabric. So I haven't really worked with canvas before, and certainly this cotton laminate is very new to me. So I'll be reporting on those experiments in future episodes.
Acorns are dropping off my Jenny's house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Leaves are down like a lady, waiting for a naked man. River bends like an elbow, turning stone to sand. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Sycamore trees are blazing like a rainbow fire. Just like Linda Kurtz sings, burn out on a wire. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed today's episode, I hope you will consider joining the Yarns at Yinhu group on Ravelry, leaving a star rating or a review on iTunes, or following me on social media. Music for today's episode is Sweet, music and lyrics by Samuel St. Thomas, performed by Krista Long and Cesar Diaz. Eat well and stay strong as you hone your post-apocalyptic skill set this week.
It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.